Welcome to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim, your host, and I'm in the studio here today with Andy Steiger.
It's good to be here with Francis Chan today.
We'll talk about that in just a moment's time. And we also have a special guest here today with us, Kyle Meeker. He is the, what's your title here exactly?
Pastor of Discipleship.
Yeah, that's right.
And by here, we mean Northview. Kyle's a pastor at Northview. And welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Yeah, I listen to you guys regularly, and it's good to be in as a guest, and great to have Steve welcome. I think it was just because another bald man was joining Andy that Steve...
So this our studio right now is extra bright today because there aren't just two bald men. There's three. I began losing hair some 10 years ago, And I figured, I went through the whole, five stages of grief and all that stuff.
Oh, dude.
And then finally, I took the plunge just the other day.
People don't realize how emotional it is to lose your hair and to come to that moment where you pull out a razor, you look in the mirror, you give yourself a long talking to, and you start shaving.
Yeah, I tried to grow a bit back earlier this year.
And which
was,
I enjoyed
it was
thoroughly.
A miserably failed attempt.
Yeah, I sent a picture of my new bald head to my brother, and he called me crazy, and he laughed about it, and then he said, you should have taken more pills, those hair regrowth pills or something like that.
Oh, that's always encouraging. But at any rate, Steve looks like Francis Chan,
apparently,
which is pretty fantastic.
I just need to take my glasses off and grow out my goatee just a little bit more, a touch more.
Nice. My son actually asked me the other day, he said, Dad, am I going to go bald when I get older? And I looked at him, I'm like, yeah.
probably.
These genes are strong.
Well, it goes to the maternal
He wasn't
father,
too happy about
right?
that. That's what they say, but that's a lie. That is a dirty, dirty lie.
Everything on the internet is not true?
It's not true because my mom's dad has had hair to the very end, and I didn't get any of that.
Yeah, I think in my case, too, I remember seeing a picture. I think it was my mom's dad. I'm pretty sure it was, and he had a full head of hair, and he was very old. And so I was hopeful. And I was let down by my genes.
Yeah. Oh, I've been there. People ask me, Andy, when did you start losing hair? And I tell them, man, this is right out of the womb. I never had a chance. Good Lord never gave me a chance. I really never did have a full head of hair.
As Andy likes to say, our good Lord likes to humble Andy Steiger.
Yeah.
And that was one way.
When you're this good looking,
Is that an ongoing project?
Why are you guys laughing?
Humbling Andy Steiger.
Yeah, the Lord was like, you're going to have to take his hair. I understand. I get it, God.
All right, just a quick announcement. The Thinking Series online course, it's starting next week on Tuesday, the 13th. I misspoke, actually, in the last episode. I said the 14th, but it's actually the 13th. And the evening of the 13th, we have the webinar to help you get started. But the course itself actually is open for you to go check it out. You can just create an account and log in and go through the first module overview, and it'll help you get set up. It has the syllabus and everything.
You know what? It's a fun course. Lots of cool videos and other resources on there and different blogs to point you to. Great resource if you have a small group that you want to introduce to apologetics. So encourage you to join us this year.
Yeah, there's limited space for certificate options. So if you know you want to if you want to do that, then take action now. All right,
I'm looking forward to this topic that we're getting into today.
Yeah,
that's why we have special guest Dr. Kyle Meeker. Did his doctoral studies in the area, the topic that we want to talk about. It's an article that Steve and I came across on CNN. Mm-hmm. I think I came across it first.
Yeah, you sent it to me.
Yeah, and we realized we've got to talk about this subject.
Yeah, this article on CNN is written by Jeremy Courtney, and the title is Three Reasons to Fight Covert Christian Spycraft. And basically what he's saying is this practice of Western Christian missionaries going over to what's often called sensitive regions or close countries, and they pretend to be purely you know, business people or teachers or aid workers, but behind the scenes they're doing all this work, religious work, to convert people. And he's giving three reasons against that practice.
And what are those three? I think the first one is it's fundamentally dishonest.
Right, it's fundamentally dishonest. Secondly, it undermines the cause of religious freedom. And then thirdly, it puts a target on the backs of local Christians. So those are his three reasons, and we can talk a little bit more as we go through it.
Now, to be fair to this guy, I thought that he was passionate. Mm-hmm. He's invested. It's not like he's clearly not somebody on the periphery kind mm-hmm. of pointing his finger going, those darn Christians. You can tell it sounds to me like he's involved in mission work.
Yeah, and he himself comes from a Christian background. Now, I'm not sure if he's still practicing or anything
It sure came across to me like he is.
Yeah, or at least he certainly uses that language.
Yeah.
And so I got the impression that he is still a Christian.
So I appreciated that perspective, but
so
clearly there's a lot to discuss here.
So this is an insider, so to speak, critiquing the Christian practice of covert.
Now, Kyle, what did you do your doctoral study in?
Yeah, so the overall kind of topic was Christians interacting with the culture around them. And what I did for my research and my dissertation specifically looked at how people from with holding the Christian faith engaged in a majority Muslim context and culture. Mm-hmm. So it was looking at ways that they tried to contextualize or interact mm-hmm. and engage with people within that culture.
Mm-hmm. Because now there's some shady missionary practices in Islamic mission work that I think you got into in your doctoral work. Now, I'm forgetting the terminology that they refer to this, where a Christian missionary will adopt Muslim terminology to gain kind of their trust.
Right. So the question or the term is an insider movement, or how do you connect with people, and how much do people who come into the culture, who not from that culture or from a Christian background, how much do they try to contextualize and relate to those within that culture? But the second question is, what if someone from within that culture, from a Muslim background, becomes a follower of Christ? How much inside do they remain within their family?
For example,
within their social communities. Yeah.
So, for example, can a Christian in an Islamic nation call themselves a Muslim? Because a Muslim is somebody who submits to God.
Right, so then you start getting into how are words defined by individual peoples and individual cultures, and how are those terms related. So connected to this issue, a really close friend of mine was doing humanitarian work with the United Nations in the summer of 2001. Hmm. So this was just months before the 9/11 attacks that kind of awoke North America to the reality that a good percentage of the world is Muslim. So we were sort of settled into our westernized, secularized way of viewing the world. But then 9/11 comes in September 11th of 2001. But just months before this, this friend of mine was doing humanitarian work in Afghanistan, northern parts of Afghanistan. And people saw him, and he was obviously did not look Afghani, and so they would ask him, are you a Christian? And he was a follower of Jesus, but his response to them was actually was no. And the reason he said no wasn't to confuse them or divert them or to be like a spy. Mm-hmm. They had a really specific understanding of what Christian meant.
Right.
And Christian for these people in northern Afghanistan goes back to the former Soviet Union, and a Christian of them was a Russian Soviet soldier, mm-hmm. White looking, with a semi-automatic weapon, who drank lots of alcohol, ran around with women, and ate pork.
Right.
So in their mind, Christian in this part of Afghanistan meant basically a Russian alcohol-drinking, pork-eating womanizer.
Interestingly enough, even in the article, this is brought up that in many nations, a Christian is actually very family, or is a family tribal thing,
right?
More necessarily than it is some personal commitment that they've made or truth statement that they're making. But getting back to this idea, though, the article and what we're after here, let's just get right after it. Kyle, is this kind of mission work fundamentally dishonest?
It can be. So if somebody goes to another country specifically to spread the gospel, and hopefully we as Christians are wanting to spread the gospel wherever we are in the world, but if somebody goes to another culture, another country to do that, and they're doing it under the guise of, hey, I'm going to help build wells, and they never never touch a well or never are involved in something like that, then that's, I think he's got a point in a sense there. But most of the people I've interacted with and I've known have gone to build wells to learn language or to teach language or develop computer literacy in other countries. So they're doing a legitimate help and aid to the people there. So they're serving the broader cultural society there with what they're doing. But they're doing it as Christians, and as they do it as Christians, they can't help but build relationships and then talk to Christ along the way.
That to me raises, I think, an important issue, because oftentimes people will ask, or they'll think in their mind, particularly as a Christian, it's about conversion, and they feel, I think a lot of Christians feel fundamentally dishonest in their relationships, perhaps with a neighbor or somebody like that. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, this last weekend I went camping with my neighbor, right? And so some people could go, okay, are you camping with your neighbor for the purpose? Now, it ends up that my neighbors have started coming to church and stuff like that, but am I camping with them for the purpose of evangelizing to them because I just want to share Jesus with them? And then I think people feel really conflicted in themselves because they're like, okay, I mean, like, I've got this hidden agenda to this relationship. You know, is the relationship more than just this hidden agenda? And so one of the things that I like to think about and I like to remind myself is that I've been called, now this might sound odd to you, but I've been called to love people and I've been called to disciple people or to help bring people into this great commission of discipleship. But I don't think that we've been called to convert people.
Yeah, ultimately, conversion is a work of God because he makes us new creations. He takes our heart of stone and turns it into a heart of flesh. So ultimately, God is the immediate instrument of conversion in that sense. But he uses us along the way. And if we think of loving people in a holistic way, or if we don't separate preaching from our deeds of love, if we have our words of love and our deeds of love, we see those more united and in a more holistic way. Hopefully, that will lessen some of the burden of, oh, am I doing this? It's a false dichotomy to say, am I doing this to convert somebody or simply to bless them? Well, you're blessing them, and as you're blessing them, hopefully they see the love of Christ through you, and that awakens questions in their heart and in their mind, and then you can follow up with the truth of Christ.
Right. So that was one of the things that the author of this article was criticizing is what he called conditioning the receipt of aid on a transaction involving your faith. So often when I go to, for example, when I go visit my friends downtown Eastside or whatever, some of the friends that are working there, one of the many criticisms that they have of the various Christian ministries that are operating in downtown Eastside is that it's almost like you're making this before you can eat a meal, for example, you first have to sit down and listen through a sermon or something like that, and that leaves a very poor, like, bad taste in people's mouths, including my friends, because it feels like, well, it's like a business transaction, right? There is you're not just loving the person. You do that for the purpose of converting that person, right?
Let me push back on this, though, because this is where I get frustrated in the other way. Mm. So my wife and I are very careful what kind of organizations we will support or give money to, because I get frustrated with organizations that will go into these nations, with people that are impoverished, and they'll provide them food and schooling. But they'll never share Jesus with them.
Right.
And so one of my fundamental critiques where I get where I feel like you're being dishonest, or where I get, you know, frustrated, is asking myself, well, if I am a Christian and called to love people, well, what's the most loving thing that I can do for people? Right. You know, giving people food is great and everything, but I don't think it's the most loving thing that you can do for somebody.
Right.
I think sharing the truth with them, particularly about the, you know, the their eternal destination, is the most loving thing that I can do for them, is to have that conversation. And if food is a part of that conversation, great. But where I get frustrated is where that conversation never takes place. So there's a lot of organizations out there that give aid, but they're Christian, but they never talk about Jesus. And I don't want to have anything to do with that.
Right. And I actually, Sharina and I, my wife and I, we also refrain from supporting certain organizations, and we go with others precisely because of that. We'll go with organizations that we know.
Such as Compassion are fantastic.
Yeah.
Very holistic.
And I think but I think the challenge is, I think where people get a little frustrated is it seems coercive to sort of hold the meal back, kind of a thing, until you I think there's a spectrum there. On the one hand, you're using the food like a carrot dangling before the face of, you know, homeless people or something like that. But on the other hand, you have this weird dynamic, if it can even be called Christian dynamic, where you're not sharing the gospel at all. You're just there to provide for the physical needs and things like that. It's great, but that can't be the gospel.
What are your thoughts, Kyle?
Yeah, if you see this in a holistic, unified way, then you see how both are vitally important. If you divide them or separate them, then you can go to the extreme of only speaking the truth, but not really doing that in love, because you're not living in line with the truth yourself. So, you know, James criticized people who, you know, say be warm and well-fed, you know, give good cheer to people verbally, but don't actually help people physically. And Christ's story of the Good Samaritan, you know, it wasn't a quiz to the person who was in need, physical need of, you know, what their faith was, or, you know, what their family background was.
Right.
It was simply a recognition this person had physical need, and the, you know, the Good Samaritan, you know, provided that need for him. So if you see these as unified, as you can't speak the truth without having a context to live out the truth. And if you're living out the truth holistically, you see the whole truth of a person, where we're not simply bodies that need food. We're relational beings made in God's image who need food to live, but we also need the bread of life, as the imagery that Christ gives us. So that food from heaven is that relationship with God. So if we're relational creatures, fundamentally, we need food to live, but also, we also need that relationship interpersonally and ultimately with our Creator to have the full life that Christ came to give to us.
So let's move on then to the second point there. It says the author of this article claims that this sort of covert missionary work undermines religious freedom.
And what he means there too, just to be really clear, is and what he's arguing for is that people, the missionaries, should be very open about the fact that they are Christians, that they're missionaries, and their desire is to see you become a Christian.
Yeah, transparency is what he's advocating for. And he says, what happens if you're doing something like covert missionary work and then your cover's blown? Then it gives sort of whatever oppressive regime an excuse to target religious minorities. And
because it's confirming their suspicions that these Westerners are just missionaries in sheep's clothing coming to, you know, impose their ideals on them. Go ahead.
Particularly when in the Muslim world, as I understand it, they don't really make the distinction between religion and the state. Right. And so when I was in, for example, Indonesia on my first mission trip, you know, a bunch of Westerners coming to their Islamic backyard, so to speak, and they all considered us Christians. I mean, there were lots of non-government organizations that came that were secular, but they didn't care. In their eyes, that was Christian, and that was the Christian state, Christian government that's coming, even though these are non-government organizations, because in the Islamic worldview, they don't make the distinction between religion and politics.
Well, interestingly enough, I know from mission work that I've done in the work that we've done in places like Laos. Mm. Here you have a communist country, and they work under a very similar idea. So for a lot of these communist countries, they don't want Christians coming in because they see that Christianity and the state are connected, and that you'll impose your not just your religious beliefs, but also your political beliefs as well.
Mm-hmm. So the author of the article was saying, you know, when Muslims see Christian missionaries doing covert missionary work, that might as well be, you know, what CIA is doing in their backyard, kind of a thing. You know, to them, it's all the same.
To me, yeah. What are your thoughts on this, Kyle?
Yeah, it raises an interesting worldview that generally a Muslim has a more unified, holistic worldview where everything is connected. Mm-hmm. Here in the West, we tend to maybe separate things too much, where culture is different from religion, which is different from politics, which is different from family, which is different from work, which is different from my private life, what I mm-hmm. you know, do at home. So in a Muslim worldview, though, those things are much more integrated. And I think in a sense that that's a helpful thing for us to be reminded of, that there is that there needs to be a greater unity with our understanding of what it means to follow Christ, because he doesn't simply call us to, hey, come to church on the weekend for an hour and, you know, I'll help you out with the rest of your life. He calls us to examine every part of our life and look to live in line with who he is in all those areas of life. So culture, religion, politics, private work, you know, all these different things he calls us to be in line with and unified with. So that's a helpful reminder that things are unified. Here's where, again, to be completely dishonest and to say you're doing one thing and have no involvement in digging wells, for example, I think that's going too far. But if you're digging wells and you're doing that, and as you build relationships with people, you have the Jesus film, for example, which is a great way for people to look at the claims of Christ from the Bible. If you're doing that and giving the film away, you don't have to, I don't think, at the border say, hey, you know, while I'm here, I may also be distributing the Jesus film. You know, Rahab hid the spies from you know, the authorities of Jericho that looked to take them, and she lied about it, and she's commended for her faith. And if we look at Corrie ten Boom and the Nazis are knocking at the door, you know, does she have to say, yes, I'm hiding Jews in, you know, the wall of my
apartment? Well, I even think about Jesus. Would this also fit with him being the Messiah and not wanting that to get out right away and saying to the guys, hey, keep this quiet?
Yeah, so it's interesting that it's the messianic secret is what scholars call it. It's through the Gospels, as Jesus is presenting himself, he, through his miracles and through the disciples, he's often saying, as people recognize him as the Christ, he's saying, okay, but don't let this out. You know, keep this quiet. Well, why would that be? The whole point of Jesus coming is for the world to know. Mm-hmm. But if they have a misunderstanding from the get-go of what Messiah should be, being a strict military leader that would free them from the Roman Empire, if that's their understanding of Messiah, and he comes on the scene and he's said to be the Messiah, and that news gets out, then that will sidetrack his ministry, because the people have a wrong understanding of what Messiah is.
Would that make ethics all situational? That's a question that gets often raised. You know, say a Gestapo comes to the door. You know, are you hiding any Jews? And you say no, to save the life of the Jews. Then people say, "Oh, you're a situational ethicist." What are your thoughts on that?
This is a great question. And is the command to, you know, bear no false witness and to be honest, are those instructions? I think Kant would say, the ethical imperative is to tell the truth in all cases. So when the Jews or the Nazis come looking for the Jews, you say, "Well, here they are." Mm. I don't know. I've come to the point where if somebody like the governing authorities in Jericho or Nazi Germany, if they with their authority are seeking to deface the image of God and destroy the image of God, they've lost their right to the truth in that sense, which puts me a little bit on shaky ground, because this could easily slip into a very relativistic view of truth and truth telling. But yeah, that's just where I land on that issue, that there are some times when not telling the truth is actually okay.
Well, isn't this the fundamental problem, I think, with what he's doing here, that it's overly naive and doesn't really take into account...
You mean the author of the
article? Yeah, sorry, the author of the article. Because when I read it immediately, just I'm like, man, it's a really naive way of viewing how complicated... this subject is in the different contexts that missionaries find themselves in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess the question is what's the dynamic between being as innocent as doves on the one hand and being as crafty as serpents on the other hand? Because I like you were saying earlier, what you know, the messianic secret, how Jesus didn't want his identity to get out right away. I even remember that story from John where Jesus' brothers are encouraging him to go up to Jerusalem and show himself publicly. And Jesus says, no, I'm not going to go there. You guys go on ahead. But then he goes there afterwards. And so a lot of my friends at Bible school, they're like, oh, did Jesus just lie? And things like that. And there are all kinds of interpretations that come into, oh, maybe he just changed his mind and whatnot. Some manuscripts even add in a word to kind of soften the blow, so to speak. But where do we fall in that? The way he is advocating for this kind of radical transparency, again, I have some friends that are doing missionary work in these sensitive regions, and if they were to come out...
You would never even get there in the first place.
They're not even... It's not even going to take off, like, off the ground, and their lives would be clearly in danger. Not even... just for saying that they're Christian, their lives could be in danger. It's not like... it's a place where Christians are just tolerated, for example, and then they get deported. Some missionaries, just for revealing that they're Christians, they could be killed. So
now this leads into this last one, and you know where he argues that it puts a target on the backs of local Christians, and I think that he's right. There is. Areas with regards to Christian missionaries that we need to be especially cautious of. And, you know, with different churches and different denominations I've worked with, that we've learned some hard lessons over the years where we've made some mistakes, where we've gone into these sensitive regions and we'll come in and we'll be open about us being Christians. Mm. But then we're associating with these other Christians and we've actually, you know, indigenous. And we've actually put their lives at risk because of, you know, we now have brought a spotlight onto where they are and what they're doing.
Right.
You know, and it may not be legal, but we, you know, where we go can oftentimes bring the attention of the government that we need to be cautious of. I know that this is the case in countries like Laos. And in fact, it's one of the reasons why a lot of the missionary training that we do, if we're going to train up or teach indigenous people in Laos, isn't in Laos.
We'll, it's in Thailand.
Yeah, right. We'll take them out of Laos, train them, be with them, and then put them back because we realize how dangerous it is for us to be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is actually a really good point that the article made, and you just kind of reaffirmed, is that as you go into a new context, a new country, a new culture, you need to be really aware of what that context is like, mm-hmm. and the impact that you'll have and the unintended consequences that you bring along with you. Mm-hmm. And this is good. This is true in all forms of missionary work, making people overly dependent on outside assistance and not raising up resources and training internally. But also, that's a great example of training Christians from Laos across the river in northern Thailand, where, okay, we can't really go in there well, but they're free to come to Thailand and receive some great training. So
actually, Kyle and I both have been
it's fascinating
to Thailand and trained up pastors,
many
of whom have done time in a Laos prison.
Yeah, missing fingers because of their love for Christ.
In fact, this last year, we had one of our pastors was murdered that we work with. And so it's a very real threat So I think he brings up a good point that you do. We do need to be cautious.
Mm-hmm. The one sentence really stuck out to me when I was reading this article. He said, "As long as we hold on to our passports and our round trip tickets, allowing us to escape when things get tough, we don't get to decide how indigenous Christians should cope with their reality." And isn't that often the case when we go to these places where they are short term? But it's the local Christians that will actually have to bear the burden of state persecution in whatever form it may come and actually live through it all their lives there, potentially. And so, I thought out of all the points, that third point I thought was I resonated with it, really.
And I think short-term missions and missions from the West has learned a lot, often through mistakes, of keeping that in mind. And I think we as a church are doing better at recognizing where we can help and how we can help. We're a global society as the body of Christ, and we can learn as much from the pastors. And I learned actually a lot more from the pastors from Laos and Thailand in their context and their faithfulness than they probably learned from me while I was there. So we are a unified body of Christ who can learn from one another.
Okay. Well, that's a good note to end on. Thank you, Kyle, for joining us. And thank you, listeners, for listening in on the conversation. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with some other interesting topics.